So, last time we talked a bit about starting introducing networking. So you mentioned we have our layers that we kind of have this way where we don't want to like build all the networking functionality all at once, so we'll build it in pieces. So we'll build some physical layer that knows how to transmit bits like over a radio, but then we need to like deal with, well, multiple computers are using that radio at the same time, so we'll build this link layer that knows how to, you know, share that radio space with multiple computers. Then we'll build a network layer which knows, well, you know, I'm transmitting on my local radio, I actually want to get the data to some machine far away on a completely different network. How do we do that? Well, we'll build another layer that handles adding that functionality given that we have the local networks implemented. And then we said, well, that's going to provide us with this kind of model where we can send data, but it's not really reliable. We can't send streams of data, like a big file. So on top of that, we'll build what we call a transport layer, where we'll implement kind of reliability in streams. And we saw how to do that with acknowledgments and sequence numbers and timeouts. And then on top of that, we'll build our actual applications like web browsers and web servers and so on. That was kind of our sort of brief foray into networking. And, you know, with a little more detail on kind of the basic way we take this mailbox model, this sort of simple to implement, relatively, kind of simple to implement functionality our network layer gives us, and turn that into reliable stream transport that like we can move a file from one place to another, even though that the functionality the network provides sort of at the lower level is much simpler. And then we briefly talked about some other ancillary networks that are very important. One of these is kind of names versus addresses. We learned that the way our network layer worked is our addresses were nicely organized so that you could quickly look at an address and decide where to send it. But this nice organization meant the addresses were not usable by us, so we want some translation where we have these names, these convenient labels for machines that correspond to addresses that are not so convenient. And we learned that a system for doing that was this domain name system, where basically we divided up the responsibility for different subsets of these names based on kind of the sort of actual organizational control, and have some way of, you know, going up this hierarchy to find the actual name. And we also do this caching idea where, you know, we don't always like ask the people responsible for the root server, you know, how do I find .com? You remember, oh, well, I've gone to the com servers before, the Virginia.edu servers before. I can, you know, remember that information for a while. Okay, so questions about things we covered last time? Okay, so I guess I will talk about one of the quiz questions, the first quiz question. And in the first quiz question, we had code that let me do outline. So it acquired a lock, and it said while. So I'll use kind of sudo used x not equal to 0 CV weight while used y not equal to 0 CV weight, then do something, then, you know, CV broadcast, or CV signal, actually, in this case, and then unlock. And there was a question about whether this kind of was susceptible to deadlock. And I think this question, we should have written it a little better by doing what we normally would do in this case, and that's inserting an unlock and a lock there, in which case it would very clearly be susceptible to deadlock with two calls to these. This, in the question, it was a transfer function. I think without, I'd say it seems most likely it's susceptible to deadlock because, you know, if you imagine another function that sets the locked field, I'm calling it used to just for clarity here, and does something and then resets it, like that would be sufficient to make this sort of turn into a deadlock scenario. Like, it would be kind of silly to have a system where transfers are only function for dealing with these accounts. You know, there's going to be other things around there, and this design and transfer like is susceptible to a deadlock because we have this waiting without ordering here. And as long as we can start waiting, we can trigger that sort of circular waiting between two calls to transfer, you know, as long as there's some reason for them to start waiting. I agree in the existing code, like I think we made a, you know, did not give the best version of the question because we don't unlock, so to give it an opportunity for two transfer calls that don't, one transfer call that doesn't wait initially to like trigger the waiting scenario initially, but, because that's sort of what the design should have been. I'll think about what to do about the key for this question, but the, because of that sort of subtlety that I think wasn't intentional because we forgot to release the lock while we shouldn't have needed it in that middle point of the operation. Where the idea here is that we don't need to lock the sort of use structure, you know, after we've set, I'm missing an important thing here, which is that, and then we have used X, used Y equals one, and we had used X equals one. Right, so we set used to one. Once we've done that, we don't need to hold the lock anymore while they're marked as used. But that wasn't done in the code, as it probably should have been to like illustrate the kind of intended scenario. Because if we don't do that, like we're effectively saying we only do one transfer at a time, which is kind of silly if we're doing this way. Right, that's a different problem. I'll ask my TAs for opinions about what we should do about that question. But I would say like, if we have any other code manipulating that list of what's locked and what's not, which probably we should, or else it doesn't really make sense to have only a transfer function, then there's a chance for a deadlock there. Because if anything can ever be locked, if we ever start waiting, we run into this problem where we can trigger a deadlock. So questions on that first quiz question? Yeah. Why should the signal be replaced with a broadcast? Because we released two used variables that two different threads could be waiting for. Or. We only have one mutex, but remember multiple threads could have called CV wait earlier on, and we could have released that mutex. Right, so we know based on sort of the purpose of that locked array that that threads are going to choose different subsets. We set two of them to zero. There could easily be two different threads that are waiting for each of those two different things to be zero. And we want to make sure both of them wake up. That's one reason. So another reason, there's actually two reasons. So another reason is that, remember, signal chooses kind of a random thread. So if we have some threads that are waiting for use one to be true, and some waiting use one to be zero, and some lock one to be zero, and some waiting for lock 10, if we call signal, it's going to choose the one of them, and it might choose the wrong one. Does that answer your question?
Not fully, but.
Okay, yeah, but I think the biggest reason is that like signal, if we have threads waiting on different locked elements, some of them can't go. Do you agree with that?
Yeah.
Signal might wake that one up. And that, rather than the one that can go. So we need to use broadcast to avoid that issue. Okay. Other questions? Okay, so let's. So let's go back. One other thing we want to talk about that comes up in networking is URLs and URIs. These are things you've seen. We're just going to talk a little about their structure, so on. So URL stands for Uniform Resource Locator. And this is kind of a name for a generic way to find a resource on a network. You most commonly see these used for web pages, but as the uniform suggests, it's intended to work for everything you could find in a network. And maybe some things you can't find in a network. And there's this more general category of things called uniform resource identifiers that, you know, is URIs plus cases where they're kind of not complete. And we'll look at those since that's what we see. So here are a whole bunch of examples. And so one thing to observe is we have like kind of our normal web page thing, and we have all these components. Sometimes they're not all there. We'll mention what each of them are briefly in a second. So we can see sometimes these can be omitted. We can also have these for other protocols. So SFTP is a way of doing file transfer over SSH. So we can have URLs, URIs for SFTP. We can have URIs that don't really represent something on a network. Well, not a computer network, like this telephone room. We can also have parts of URIs omitted where it's kind of implied from context. So for example, here, this is a valid URI, but it only makes sense if we can fill in kind of the rest of the information, like we're missing, you know, in all these other URIs we have, oh, this is on this computer. Here we don't have that information, but that's fine. What happens is based on where we're getting the URI from, we'll kind of use those values as a default. So if I'm getting this from www.csfreunity.eu, I'll just say, well, I don't know what server it's on from the URI itself. I'm going to guess it's on the same one I got it from. And similarly here, we don't know that this is HTTPS from the URI itself, but we'll infer if we start on an HTTPS page place to get this, that we should use HTTPS here. Some questions on our URI examples. Okay. And kind of our general syntax is we have what's called a scheme, which says what protocol to use. So we saw HTTPS and SFTP and telephone as examples. We have what's called the authority, and you know, typically we see this as just a host name, a name of a machine. We also say it can also include a port number. And it can also include a username part. We have a path, you know, which typically means a file name, but we might have some other meaning in some cases. And appended to the path, we sometimes have what's called a query. And this is so-called because the most common use is for something like a search term. So like, you might see if you search for thing I search for, you might see Q equals thing I search for at the end of a URL. Yes?
How does a URI handle if your path has like special characters in it? Like if my path has a question mark in it, how does it know that the next part is not a query?
Question, how do we handle special characters? So there is an escaping scheme, which is basically percent and two hex characters for special characters. That's the most common way, and the other thing is probably some characters you're just not allowed to do. There's also a different solution for another case that comes up is that we might want our host to be an IPv6 name, IPv6 address. And if you remember how we wrote IPv6 addresses, we use colons. So what they typically do for that is that we'll write an address like this. This is our IPv6 address, and then a port number with brackets. Does that answer your question? Okay. And we also have this optional part called a fragment after a pound sign or octothorpe, whatever we call that these days, which is represents a place in the resource. So the fragment part is not actually communicated with the server. So in this URI here, the part that actually is used to get the resource from the server doesn't include that pound Q2 at the end. That's just something we do when processing the result locally. And usually this is like used for a part of a web page or something like that. And pretty much all these components are optional in the right context. So that's my brief foray into URIs, which we just want to make sure everyone who's a CS major knows before they graduate, for obvious reasons. Okay. So one other thing we didn't figure out with networking is getting IP addresses. We said we have, every machine has an IP address, but probably you haven't actually set the IP address of your machines. And even though that's an option, right, we could have the sysadmin choose that. That sometimes is what we do. We could have the machine choose one by itself, but that doesn't really work with routing. That's kind of a valid option if we only care about contacting local machines. It doesn't really work if I want to have my machine be able to talk to other machines on the internet, because they have to be able to get back to me. So we'll typically want to ask some machine in the local network to assign IP addresses. And this is commonly known as auto configuration, because it configures things, but you don't do anything. And so usually what happens is some local router machine, some router that's on your local network, will run a service to assign IP addresses. And because this is a router and has routing tables, it, you know, can be have knowledge of what IP addresses are available to assign. Also, this is a case where we could have a system administrator configure what IP addresses get assigned to what machine, not by actually configuring the individual machines, but by kind of entering in this router, hey, when you're assigning IP addresses, this MAC address, assign it this IP address, please. But how do we ask a machine in the local network? And a problem we have here is that we don't have an IP address. So how do we communicate with the machine in the local network without an IP address? And you might say, oh, well, obviously, we're not going to use IP. That seems like the solution, right? If we don't have an IP address, we can't use IP. That's not the solution DHCP has chosen. DHCP uses IP. So you might say, what do they do there? It's done over UDP, which is over IP. And since we don't have an IP address yet, we just use the L0s one. And we also don't know what the router is yet, because, well, that's going to be different in every network. So we send to this special address, which is all ones. Yes, I know it's not written as all ones here, but if we write it in binary, it will be all ones. And that's a special address that represents everyone in the local network. So we send that request, and then the local server will reply with the address for us to use and a time limit. And later on, if we want to keep using that address and the time limit's about to expire, we can send another message to say, hey, I'd like you to extend my time limit. Okay. So questions about this kind of basic? Oh, so we're connecting to a new Wi-Fi network. Our machine doesn't have any IP addresses. We just send this packet message out to everyone on the network, and the router is going to respond and say, yep, that's for me. Here's your address. And, it's valid for 4 hours. Check back with me in 4 hours, before then if you want to keep using it. So a question you might have is, why do we have this time limit? Especially since, as I mentioned on this slide, we can actually give up addresses. That's a valid option for us to do. And the problem is that if we don't have a time limit, let's say I connect to a Wi-Fi network here, and then I walk away. well, my machine probably, you know, doesn't know I'm really walking away, so it's not going to give up the address. You know, it's just going to get out of range, and then we'll have that address reserved forever. So the way DHCP avoids this is we always have a time limit, and we just say if you don't manage to renew in that time, you lose the address. And your machine knows, because it got the time limit in its original response, that it lost the address and it needs to fix that. You know, if, for example, I walk away from UVA's wireless network and then come back after a day, you know, my machine will know, well, this IP address isn't valid anymore. I need to get a new one before I keep going. Okay. So one practical consideration here is that when we get an IP address, we often won't get a quote-unquote real IP address. So in IPv6, usually you'll get just a nice address that works across the whole internet. In IPv4, we don't have enough addresses to do that. There's only 4 billion of them, maybe like 3 billion of them are useful, and there are more people times devices for per person than that by a big margin. So what we commonly use is we use some private IP addresses, which you mentioned before, and we kind of represent them as a single public one. So we'll have some router that, rather than just forwarding packets, it's going to do this conversion from private IP addresses to public ones, such that multiple private IP addresses will share one public address. But then we have a problem of, like, when I get a packet coming in for that public address, how do I know which private address it goes to? And the basic idea is that we're going to keep a table on that router of the active connection. So we'll say, okay, there's a connection from this internal IP address of 192.168.1.5 from port number 43222, and it goes to this remote IP address and port from this port number on the public IP address. And when a packet comes in from the network, we'll look up what's its source address and what's its destination port number. We'll look it up here and figure out how to fill in, when we're forwarding it on the private local network, you know, the actual destination address and port number. A challenge here is we have to update this table as connections are made. We also, like, don't want to, like, get things out of the table as connections go away, which gets tricky, because if it's actually a little tricky to know when a connection goes away all the time. But that's kind of how network address translation, which is, you know, if you're using IPv4, you almost certainly are using, you know, almost everywhere, because IPv4 addresses are relatively scarce and, you know, cost, you know, tens of dollars, maybe hundreds of dollars per address, tens of dollars per address, something like that. Questions about network address translation? Okay. So if you look on the schedule, we have a lab on networking coming up. And I will talk about a few things in that lab, because, you know, some people have found them confusing in the past. So in the lab, we're going to have a message being sent to you in pieces, and you're going to implement acknowledgments, kind of like what we saw, where the idea is when you request each part of the message, and we're going to call that request an acknowledgment of the previous part, because that's kind of how acknowledgments works. We don't ask for, when we acknowledge part one, that's kind of a way of asking for part two, and that's how that protocol is going to work. You're going to implement the part of this where you first ask for part zero, and then you ask for part one. By acknowledging part zero, you ask for part two by acknowledging part one, and so on. And you need to handle resending your request if you don't get what you need. So if you ask to get part zero and you don't get anything, you need to ask again. If you acknowledge getting part zero to get part one and you don't get anything, you need to ask again, and so on. And the protocol we have is that there are four different messages you can receive, and you'll initially request the first part of the message, part zero, by using get x, where x is the scenario, where scenario zero is the simplest, scenario three is the most complicated in terms of how well you have to implement the acknowledgement functionality and the similar functionality. And after you get the initial part sent correctly, which might require retrying, then you have to acknowledge sequence number n of the message to get sequence number n plus one. Yeah. So that's the protocol. So questions on that protocol? So the way you're going to program this is the biggest thing I want to go over, and that this is callback-based programming. So we're going to provide you with a library, and inside the library, there's basically code that looks like this. We have this loop that runs pretty much indefinitely that checks for an event, like a packet being received or a timeout happening, and then calls a function that you write based on that. So these function calls go to your code. So you're writing code that I'm calling callback-based programming. We're going to call you back, and that's the code you write. You don't get to write this loop, and your code, therefore, one of the things your code should not do is your code should not, like, wait for 1 minute, 1 second to retransmit. Instead, you should get us to call you back in one of these functions. Because if this loop doesn't run, nothing happens. So kind of what we expect you to do is that you're going to probably send your first message and maybe do some other setup. And if you want to make something happen later, so this might also happen down here, you're going to call this setTimeout function, so we will call you back at some time later. You aren't going to call a function like sleep. You're going to arrange to be called back later. And when you want to deal with receiving a message, you aren't going to do something like call read. Instead, we're going to call this function called received, and that's where you're going to handle reading something. You aren't going to be able to, you know, read the next thing. Instead, you have to have the code in the receive function handle getting the next thing. Probably how you'll do this is you'll, like, have some if statements where you check some variable, global variables, where you track, you know, what have I gotten before and so on. Questions? Interface. Okay. And so, yeah. One of the reasons we're doing this lab this way, you know, and not like redesigning it to be more like the read and write model, is because in addition to being a convenient way for us to build the lab infrastructure, this is a really common programming practice in reality for non-networking context even. So like if you're writing scripts in a web page, this is the programming model the browser gives you. The browser is going to want you to give it functions for it to call, not for you to like wait for a second. That's not a thing a browser wants you to do. If you're using many of the graphical user interface libraries that are out there, they are very often expect you to code in this style. So that's everything I have on networking for basic thing. We're going to move on to our next topic, which is a networking adjacent. And this is going to be about secure communication. And we're going to kind of mostly think about doing this over a network, but all the things I'm going to talk about are kind of agnostic to how we're sending messages to people. We're just communicating between what we'll call, for lack of a better term, principles, which might represent people or servers or programs. And like, we'll mostly be thinking about this in terms of communicating on a network, but the same ideas apply for like saving information securely on a disk. In this case, you're communicating with yourself. You might say, well, okay, if that applies here, like, what does securely mean? And well, we're going to have to think about what types of problems do we care about, and we're going to care about adversaries. So the idea is we have someone who can somehow interfere or get access to our communication we want to protect against. And our running example will be that we'll have A talking with B. And we'll mostly be talking about two types of adversaries, so two types of malicious people who, you know, are going to try to mess up the communication between A and B in some way. And one of these is going to be an eavesdropper. So this is someone who gets access to the contents of the communication, but gets to read all the messages. If this is over network, everything sent over the network, they get to see. The other, I'll call M, is a machine in the middle. So they get to, you know, not only read all the messages that are sent, they can also replace them, they can add their own messages. So you might say, like, well, you know, what is this kind of, I'm giving you kind of this abstract idea, what does this kind of represent in reality? So like a passive attacker, this eavesdropper, might represent what access you'd have if you had like a Wi-Fi receiver and someone's communicating over Wi-Fi. But you just have a receiver, you aren't sending anything. Machine in the middle might represent what happens if you convince someone to connect to your special Wi-Fi router that, you know, maybe doesn't, you know, route things in the normal way. It does some custom stuff that this malicious attacker has set up. That's not the only possible scenario, but that's, you know, kind of the two models we're going to talk about. And we have these adversaries, but what are they trying to mess up? What does it mean to mess up the communication? And there's different ideas we could have. I'm going to focus on two different properties that are very commonly cared about. One of them is what we'll call confidentiality, that the information in the communication is shared only with those who are supposed to have it. So other people might receive the communication, but they won't get any information out of it other than the information they're supposed to have. The other property we'll care about is what we'll call authenticity, that if A receives, or if B receives a message from A, then B knows it actually came from A, and B's not going to confuse the message from A with the message from M, even if the message is marked as coming from A. And this is what we'll call authenticity. That not only, and when we say authenticity, not only do we mean that the message really comes from A to B, but also that the message is what A actually tried to send and not like some corrupted version of it. And as I said, we're going to focus on these security properties. These aren't the only choice out there. There are other very reasonable choices for security properties that many systems out there try to give us that we aren't addressing. So one example is repudiation, that we might really care that if I send a message to you, that you can't have a proof to someone else that I sent that message to you. And we have a few other properties. Another good example is anonymity, that we might really want A and B to talk without B knowing who A is. You know, that's kind of the opposite of authenticity, right, in some senses. But as I said, we're not going to focus on those properties. Those other security properties, we're just going to focus on confidentiality and authenticity because these are the most common. Like, but you know, you might have other goals which will need different solutions. Now, a fundamental problem with giving confidentiality or authenticity is that, you know, if A and B are talking, communicating, how do B has to have that look different than M and B communicating. But in order for that to happen, there has to be something different about, or A and M communicating, I'm using this example. In order for, you know, A talking to M to look different to A than A talking to B, right, there has to be something different about what B and M know. If not, then M can generate the exact same messages that B generates, and there's no way to tell the difference. And the way we're going to break this symmetry, we're going to make sure our machine in the middle can't do all the same things that our intended other party to the communication can do, is we're going to assume that B knows some information M doesn't know. There's going to be multiple versions of this we're going to work through. I'm going to start with the simplest version, which is that we're going to assume that A and B know some shared secret information that they both have. So that A and B have some shared information that none of the attackers know. You might say, how do we do this? And that's indeed a complicated question. And is a reason we're going to have some other models later on, is because this scenario is hard to set up. But a way you might imagine this working in practice is that if I want to communicate with someone else, we meet in person, we exchange the secret information, and then later on we communicate over something where there's an attacker, an eavesdropper, or a machine in the middle. But we have some advanced setup process where we, in some way that we're convinced it actually shares the information with only between the two of us, gets us this shared secret. So we have this shared secret. How do we use it? And, you know, we have to do something a little sophisticated, right? It's not a password. We can't say, hey, what's the password? Here's the password. Okay, here's the information that's, you know, supposed to be confidential. This doesn't work, right? If we, you know, if we have our machine in the middle, like, is going to see all this information here. Our eavesdropper is going to see all this information here. Like, the shared secret didn't help us. Also, after we do this exchange, our eavesdropper knows the password. There's the secret information. And our machine in the middle can pretend to be A in this process. Yeah. So that doesn't help either. So we're going to need some other tools. And the other tools we're going to have are going to be mathematical tools. And I am very deliberately going to, mostly with one exception, avoid going into like real mathematical details about how these mathematical tools work. I'm going to try to present them as a, here's some tool a mathematician's going to give us, and here are the properties it has. How do we use that effectively? And our first mathematical tool is going to be something called symmetric encryption. And here, our expert is going to give us two functions that we'll find useful for using our shared secret. So we'll have an encryption function that's going to take our message and produce what we'll call a ciphertext. And our decryption function will undo that operation. And these will use a key, which will be constructed from our shared secret. And the expert that gives us these functions is going to ensure that even if our attackers, our eavesdropper and our machine in the middle, know E and D, that, and know the ciphertext, that it's going to be really, really hard for them to learn about anything about the message from that information. So even if they know both of these functions and the ciphertext, that's not going to be enough for them to get anything useful. And by really hard, what we're aiming for is that it's essentially as hard as trying every possible key. Like, might not be exactly that hard, but it's going to be essentially that hard. And that means if we can just make sure there's too many possible keys to try, that's going to be enough to protect us from our adversaries. And note that I'm saying here, learn anything about the message. So I'm not like saying we can't like find out the message. I'm saying we can't like find out, you know, if the message starts with an A or a B, right? Or we can't find out the message is more likely to start with an A than a B, other than things that, you know, from this information. We might guess that because, you know, most messages start with an A, more messages start with an A and a B in English, but the ciphertexts and the encryption and decryption functions won't give us any hints about that. And actually, most of the functions that you'll see experts give you are going to actually be stronger than what I just said. Like here I'm saying that given the ciphertext, we can't learn anything about the message. They're actually stronger than that. That they'll say that given a lot, if you know a lot of ciphertext and their corresponding messages, and then I give you a new ciphertext, you won't know, that won't help you. That's another property they want. So so-called known plaintext attacks should be not be possible. That if I know a bunch of ciphertexts and the corresponding messages, if I get a new one, doesn't help me without the key. If I, even if I choose some of the messages, if I know what they are, if I chose some of the messages, that doesn't help me learn anything about any other messages or the key. And even if I know like that maybe we use similar shared secrets and I know the ciphertext there and the messages, that also shouldn't help me. So the experts will give us a function that's extremely strong. So not only does it prevent us from learning information, it like even prevents it from happening if the attacker knows a lot about some kind of closely related things. So if they know other ciphertext and messages, not going to help them. If they know sort of other keys and the corresponding ciphertext and plain text, and the keys are close, not going to help them. Or if they don't know the keys, but they know the messages and ciphertext. Or they like choose some ciphertext for us to generate because, you know, we're like sending a copy of their message, not going to help. Okay, so we have this very nice function our expert gave us. Let's try to use it. So kind of the intuition is that we'll take this function, we'll put our sensitive data into the message part with the key, and we'll get something out. I'm representing it as stars. It's going to be like some bunch of bytes that are not really intelligible, hopefully. We'll send that on the network. When B receives it, B is going to use their key, compute the result of decrypting it, and get the result. Great. So this gives us confidentiality, that our attacker can't learn anything about the secret formula if they intercept this message because they don't have the key. And they can't do it even if we send a whole bunch of different secret formulas and they know some of them. They can't learn the other ones. But this doesn't actually solve the problem of authenticity. And that's not intuitive. And you might say, well, you know, why doesn't it do that? And you might say, okay, so maybe a way we could solve that is like, if this is not authentic, what would be happening is our man in the middle would change this to be, you know, something else. And then when we compute decrypting something else, surely we'll just get junk, right? Like that's most people's thought about this. And it's a very reasonable idea, right? This function like is really hard to predict deliberately. It's designed that way. Surely it should be the case that our attacker is not gonna like manipulate the message in a useful way. Like maybe they can corrupt it, but like they're not gonna do anything more interesting than that. But that is not true in practice. In practice, if we just do encryption, an attacker can selectively manipulate the message in are often in very useful ways to them. So we're going to need some other tool to provide the authenticity part. And as I said, it's not intuitive. So this is the one point where I'm going to go into kind of one version of the mathematics for an encryption function. So here's one idea for implementing that encrypt function and the corresponding decrypt function. That what we'll do is when we get our message, we'll generate a unique number n, maybe unique by being a counter, and we'll combine n and the key to produce a sort of a hard to predict string of bits I'll call 1. So we have some function where we pass n and a key, and we get this long string of bits. And then I'm going to XOR that long string of bits with the message. That's going to be my ciphertext. And the idea is that if this function f is hard to predict, so it's going to be something like a hash function, and we're going to design it to be very hard to reverse and very hard to predict, other than like just being looking random, right? Everything is going to be equally distributed. There's no pattern in it. So we build that function, and we build encryption with it. And this encryption design, if f is a good enough function, gives us all the properties we liked. We can't figure out anything about the message. If we have two different messages, because they have different ends, they're completely unrelated, so having old messages with other ends doesn't tell us about messages with this end. So it actually gives us all the security properties that I showed you earlier. It avoids known plaintext attacks because, well, that's going to be for the wrong end. We always choose a unique end. So we learn nothing. As long as f is good enough, that like the two different f results are not predictably related to each other. But this message, even though it's secure, we can actually still, manipulate messages. And probably the key reason why is that our encrypt function, like, we always choose a different end. Our attacker doesn't need to care about that. So our attacker, what they're going to do is we're going to get this message, and let's say we're going to do a known ciphertext example, known plaintext example. Let's say I know what this message was, or I guess what the message was. Then I'm going to say, okay, I can take the original message, and I have my C here. Remember, this is C. So I used F of my number and my key, XORed with the message, that's C, and I can XOR that with the message again. And that expands to F of n key, XORed with the message, XORed with the message. And XOR is commutative, so I can rewrite that like this here. And anything XORed with itself is zeros. So I end up with a result of just getting the result of f of n XORed with zeros, which is the same as what would happen if I, would be a possible result of ek of zero. So I've changed the message from what it originally was to a message of all zeros. And I can extend this. Let's say I want to make the message be q instead. Well, instead, I just XOR it with the message XORed with q. That's going to give me zero, the message XOR zero, XOR q, which ends up being the message XOR q. So this scheme, even though it meant all our security properties, it does allow manipulating the message. We can take one encrypted message and turn it into a different message that will also decrypt, but to something of our choice, if we know enough about the original encrypted message. And how would we know enough? Like, probably in practice, we'd guess. How could we guess? Well, let's say our message is pay $100 to Bob. We might have some context, if we're attacking the situation, about that happening, and we could guess that that's the message, even if we don't know. And this would be a case where we probably really care if this like changes to paying a different amount. We can also do some other manipulations here that I didn't mention explicitly. So one is that we could shorten messages, right? I can just just pretend the message is shorter, and maybe that's a bad, maybe that gives me something useful. I can also, if I don't know the full details about the message, I can corrupt different parts of it selectively and see what happens with how the recipient of the message responds. And so a complaint you might have about this is I went through this vulnerability. You might say, well, this simple encryption idea, that's stupid. Why are we building encryption with this XOR thing? You know, surely there's a better way of doing it. And there's a different way of doing it. But this XOR-based scheme is actually probably the most common in practice. And the other ideas that avoid having this kind of direct bit manipulation are still vulnerable to manipulation. You just have, it's just a little more, it's more complicated what you can do with that manipulation because it has to be on sort of larger units than bits. It has to be on usually like blocks or bytes or something like that. Instead, we're going to have a different solution to the authenticity problem, which is a message authentication code. And we'll talk about that in a bit. I would like to notice one thing about the sort of name here. So what I've called encryption, or what we'll see as symmetric encryption, is the most common thing when a library gives you symmetric encryption, you'll usually have something like this, like what I've talked about. But sometimes they'll give you something that is either the quote-unquote fixed version, so adding message authentication codes, which I will call authenticated encryption, and sometimes they'll give you something which is more like F and you have to do the extra work to actually get the rest of it. But most of the time they'll give you this thing which gives you confidentiality but not authenticity, and that's what we're gonna, when I talk about symmetric encryption in the class, that's what we're gonna assume. And that's what I want to teach because like one of my main goals of this unit is that if you use a cryptography library in the future, that you maybe don't screw it up. Okay, so questions about our encryption and malleability. Okay, so I mentioned our fix was going to be message authentication codes. So what is a message authentication code? Well, we're going to take our message and combine it with the key to get attack. And this is kind of like, and sometimes you might even see it called, a keyed hash, you know, or keyed checksum. So like the checksum, the idea is that the tag is really, really unlikely to match by chance. The tag typically will be like short, like a fixed size, like a hash or checksum. But since it depends on the key, and our expert who designed this message authentication code function is going to ensure that it's really hard to figure out what the tag should be without the key. So it's really hard to find the value of the tag for a message other than the one you already have, even if you have a whole bunch of valid tags. You can't like say, oh, you know, the tag for A is this, therefore the tag for B is something that doesn't work. The function is going to make that very hard to do without the key. And this kind of shows it's very similar to a checksum. You know, but we have this added key, and the checksum, you know, has different design goals in addition to not having a key. Like a checksum's meant to prevent events accidents, which mean, and the message authentication code needs to prevent against malicious manipulation. So a checksum will often be faster to compute and might guarantee like certain types of manipulation change the checksum in a certain amount. Whereas the message authentication code typically can't do that because it needs to be kind of hard to predict what happens when you manipulate things. It needs to look like it's producing random output, roughly. So how do we use this message authentication code? Well, we'll use our shared secret again, which we'll call our message authentication code key in this case, and we will pass that, you know, pass our message into that function, produce this tatmac tag that's going to be kind of like a checksum. We'll send our message along with its MAC tag. You know, I'm showing it as a bunch of at signs, but really it's going to be a bunch of bytes that, you know, are don't have any special meaning to anyone but A and B. And B is going to recompute the MAC tag and compare it. And if it doesn't match, well, something happened to the message. Maybe it got corrupted, or maybe an attacker manipulated it. Yes? What's having a change in the three at? So this is going to actually be sort of binary data here. And the problem is that the structure of our MAC tag means that if we, so M can change it, in which case the message will be rejected. I'd argue this doesn't let M do anything they already can't do, because M could just not forward the message from A to B. Does that answer your question? So, but M can't change it to another useful message for them, because if they just change the tag, they're making B reject the message. If they just change the message, they're making B reject the message. If they change the message in the tag, if they don't change the tag to exactly match their new message, B will still reject the message. And because they don't know the key, they can't produce the correct tag for a new message. Does that answer your question? They don't know how to compute the MAC? Well, yeah, so they know this MAC function, they know the value of this message here, but they don't know the key, and that's going to prevent them from computing the MAC. Does that answer your question? Okay. Other questions? Okay, and often we'll combine this with encryption, so we'll encrypt our message to get some encrypted data, and typically what we'll do is then we'll take a message authentication code over that encrypted data and send that, and then we'll send the MAC tag and our encrypted data together. And B will first check the MAC tag. If the MAC tag doesn't match, B doesn't bother decrypting, because we know it's not the right message or something else got messed up. And we want to do it in this order. You know, we want to encrypt and then take the message authentication code. The idea being that we don't want to take stuff an attacker gave us and even pass it to our decryption function. And as I mentioned, this combining this together gives us what we call authenticated encryption. So encryption and MAC packaged together, that's authenticated encryption. And that is a useful tool. It's very often when you pick up a cryptography library and look at the encryption function, not what the encryption function does. So let's do a little exercise. So let's say A and B, we have these shared keys that no attackers have, K1 and K2. And we use this method to ask, you know, B to pay Sue $100. We send these messages, and my question is, what does the eavesdropper or machine in the middle learn? And you might say, yeah, we've made some poor choices here by not just encrypting and mapping everything. Yes, we have. So how do those poor choices manifest and letting our eavesdropper and machine in the middle learn things? Or do things. Okay, who'd like some more time? Okay, so let's start with 1A. Who thinks the eavesdropper can learn who's being paid? How about how much? A bunch of people. Our machine in the middle, who thinks they can change who's being paid? Okay, some people. Who thinks they cannot change who's being paid? Okay, no clue? Okay, a bunch of no clues. Okay. Let's start with that. So I think eavesdropper is most straightforward. The encrypted value is not useful to the eavesdropper because they don't have K1. The MAC is not useful because they don't have K2. So the eavesdropper learns how much and doesn't learn who. As for changing who is being paid, in order to do that, we want to, we need to manipulate this here. That's the only place it exists. That's what we need to manipulate. And that's part of some encrypted data. But we mentioned encryption gives us confidentiality, not authenticity. So we can change it. And if we were having an encryption scheme which does that kind of XOR idea, how would we do it? Well, we know that we probably can guess that this many bits into the message, you know, after the first 12 bytes or so, that's where the name is. And if we flip bits there, we're changing the name of who's being paid. If we can guess that the person currently being paid is Sue, then we can change it to deliberately to some other name. If we can't guess it, we can still change it. We just won't know what we're changing it to. But we can change who is being paid. And as for changing how much, well, in order to change that, we need to edit this 100 and this 100 here. The first one, that's easy to do. Like, it's just plain text. The second one, well, we need to compute the new MAC tag with the 100 changed to some other number. And it needs to match because hopefully what the recipient B here is doing is they're going to confirm that this MAC tag matches. Now, if they don't do that, changing that 100 would just do it enough. That would be enough. Hopefully someone didn't like take a shortcut and say, well, it always matches, why am I checking? Which has happened in real code for real commercial software. But presuming they don't take that shortcut, then we need to make the MAC tag, we need to compute the new MAC tag. And we can't do that without K2. So how much can't the attacker can't do, presuming that B correctly checks the MAC tag. Okay, so questions? Our scheme here. Okay. So one issue we have with what we've shown you so far is that all the schemes I've shown you so far rely on shared secrets. And this kind of gives us a chicken and egg problem. In order to set up shared secrets, we need to have secure communication in order to have future secure communication. And in some cases, this might be okay. We meet in person this month, next month we communicate remote. But in many cases, this doesn't really work out. The other thing is I need to have separate secure communication with everyone I want to communicate with. And we want to use secure communication for some cases where that doesn't scale right. So we have millions of websites, billions of web browsers. We'd like it to be possible for your web browser to communicate securely with each of those millions of websites. And we'd like to do this without pre-arranging a trillion keys. So how are we going to handle that? So we're going to show you schemes that are easier to set up. We're still going to need some secure communication at the beginning, but we're going to address the scaling issue, and we're also going to address the issue of needing to communicate directly with your intended recipient as a kind of second step. And the big thing our tool is going to, next tool we're going to talk about is going to give us is that we're going to let you do this with broadcast communication. That rather than if I want to communicate with A, B, C, and D with the shared secret idea, I need to arrange a key to have a key with for me and A, for me and B, for me and C, for me and D, and I need to separately arrange those sort of in secret with each of them. And if B, A wants to talk to all of B, C, D, they also need to arrange another set of them, so we end up with like n squared keys we need. What we're going to have instead is that we can instead do a broadcast communication. If I want A, B, C, and D to be able to communicate with me, I can just announce some information, and then they'll all be able to communicate securely with me. And as long as that announcement is secure, it still needs to be secure, not manipulated by our machine in the middle, but as long as that announcement is secure, you know, this will work. And this is going to be important for our web browser case because, you know, we don't need a separate communication with each web browser. Instead, we can just announce, here are all the information for all the websites. That helps our scaling problem. And our kind of second step we'll talk about probably next time is we'll only have a smaller number of trusted authorities. That even though we'll have a million websites you can communicate with, you'll be able to get your initial communications from maybe only a couple hundred authorities that will kind of represent those websites in some way. So the big tool mathematically we're going to have to help us with this is going to be asymmetric encryption, and then something similar we'll call digital signatures. And asymmetric encryption is going to be like encryption, but instead of having a single key, we're going to have a key pair. So we're going to generate what we'll call a public key and a private key. And the public key can be used to produce ciphertext, but that ciphertext can only be decrypted with the private key. And this is going to give us that broadcast communication idea, that what I can do is I can generate a public-private key pair. I can keep the private key to myself. I don't tell anyone about it, not even the people I want to communicate securely with. Don't tell them. And I give the public key to everyone. And the idea here is that anyone can encrypt a message for me, but only I can read them because only I have the private key. And we will reuse this concept later on in some other tools, where we'll have this private key that's kept secret, and this public key we're going to let someone do, anyone do anything that we can kind of undo with the private key. And so we'll have all our kind of confidentiality properties guaranteed by this encrypt and decrypt function. Now, we're not going to have authenticity, and that's kind of obvious in this case because everyone has the public key. Everyone can encrypt anything they want. So if we want authenticity, we're going to need an extra step. I'm telling you here that, if I know the ciphertext and the public key, I can't, like, do this decrypt operation without the private key. Like, that's the key property. And when I talked about not being able to do that in symmetric encryption, I said it was going to be as hard as trying every possible key. With public key encryption, we're not going to be able to make it that hard. That the math like doesn't work out to make it that hard, but it's going to still be impractical. But something you'll notice is that the sizes of these keys, therefore, are going to have to be bigger because, you know, we can't just make it so you can't guess a key. We need to have, there's going to be a better way than just guessing keys to reverse this. So we need to make that still impractical, which means we need to make things big enough that that better way still takes too much time for you to have to do. Like, it's still infeasible. So we have this asymmetric encryption. So these are, very similar, and we can use them very similarly, even though they kind of work very differently, especially mathematically. With asymmetric encryption, rather than having sort of one key per, party communicating, we have one key per recipient. One key pair for recipient. The private key is kept by the recipient, never shared with anyone, not even the people who they're trying to communicate with. Public key is sent to everyone, at least to all potential senders, and we'll usually assume all the attackers have it too. And the encryption, without the private key, it's one way. That if you encrypt, that doesn't mean you can decrypt. With symmetric encryption, if you can encrypt, you can decrypt. And you need a separate key for each person you're communicating with. But the use is similar. We share the public key with everyone. So B in this case wanted to receive a message from A, so B shares the public key with A, and probably everyone else. A generates the encrypted message, which I'm representing as stars, but it's actually going to be like some uninterpretable bytes. We send that on the network, and then we compute our, use our decrypt function with our private key, which we haven't shared with anyone, to get that value back. Now, here, I mentioned earlier that this didn't provide authenticity. And it's pretty clear, that we could instead say, M does this, all these things, and M could change the secret formula. So how are we going to prevent that in this scheme? Well, we're going to have a tool that's like message authentication codes, but uses a public and private key, and that's going to be called a digital signature. And we'll fix this up next time, but basically, a digital signature is going to be, we're going to have a sign operation that produces a signature with the private key, and we'll have a verify operation which checks that signature with the public key. And that's where I'll finish up today.